Welcome to Warriors for Peace. This weekly broadcast honors the men and women from different countries and cultures who have served and fought in various ways for the peace and rights that freedom brings. There are those also who serve daily to help preserve peace and the rights that come with freedom. I call these individuals Warriors for Peace. This is Donna Sebo, and I will be your host for the next hour. Today we're going to be discussing a subject matter that in many instances is a very difficult one to discuss. It's war. It is not easy to recognize or realize that humanity in one form or another has been engaged in war for thousands and thousands of years. But today we're going to be discussing America's modern wars. You all are going to have your opinions and your judgments. But what if we come from a positioning where you do a statistical analysis that enables you to find out what it is that is going to have to be dealt with war? How does one go about this? What do you do to find out the information you need to really get to the truth that perhaps you're wanting to seek? That is something that my guest, Christopher A. Lawrence, is very much engaged with. He has been involved with history and analysis of military environments of many different shades and colors. This is a man that has walked a journey that I don't think many of us would even consider engaging in. And that is working with the reality of numbers, statistics, the positives and the negatives of being engaged in war. Christopher Lawrence, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you.
Christopher, you have dedicated this book to someone that is very, very close and dear to your heart, and that's your father, Colonel William A. Lawrence, who served two tours in Vietnam. You also, in your dedication, dedicated to all of those who died in the Vietnam War, including his friends Captain Robert Maluenda Calabozo and Major Robert William Arnold. You say, "It is unfortunate that the sacrifice of almost 60,000 U.S. servicemen and women had not been better used to educate future generations on the problems of fighting insurgencies." Do you mind if I call you Christopher?
That's fine. I usually go by Chris.
All right. Chris, how is it that you became very engaged in the use of statistics and also engaged in working with the Department of Defense? How is it that this evolved for you? This is a very, very unique environment.
It was in the process of taking... various social science courses and history courses over time, that I sort of felt that there was a need to establish some realities or truths. You know, it's one thing to have an opinion. It's another thing to know something. And to actually be able to know something, you need to be able to analyze it, which means you need to be able to quantify it. And so it was more of a sort of a realization that in the course of my education, I was learning a lot of little data, but I was not able to assemble it into an overall picture. And the only way you can be able to do that is quantify it. So it was actually a series of econometrics courses that moved me into being a quantitative social scientist, per se, and taking the desire to try to take history and then be able to quantify it to the point where you can use it to establish what you at least might know.
There were two men that influenced you very strongly to put the material together for this information, America's Modern Wars. That was Colonel Trevor N. Dupuy and Major General Nicholas Crossey. And that was, they're both men that served in the United States services. You said if it hadn't been for them, you wouldn't be in a position to do this work. What was it that they did, and how did they influence you?
Well, I first went to work for Colonel Dupuy, for Trevor Dupuy, back in 1987. And it was being able to go for his organization, work for his organization, that allowed me to start doing the analysis that I wanted to do. And I worked for him. I worked for him until he passed away in 1995. And then the organization was taken over by General Nicholas, retired Major General Nicholas Cratchew. And General Cratchew basically gave me freedom to pursue whatever research projects and efforts that I chose to, and in whatever means I chose to. So instead of he basically supported whatever we were pursuing or whatever approaches we were pursuing, so gave me the independence to be able to pursue the marketing efforts that we needed to fund this, and then to be able to do the type of work we needed to do.
Your book starts off with a particular date, April the 4th, 2004. The United States Armed Forces deployed 2,000 troops around a very, very small city in Iraq. You started off with this story. Why?
It was sort of, at the time in April 2004, it is sort of what we understood about the conflict. Meaning the United States military. We had gotten into a conventional fight over a city. It was a matter of clearing out the city, and we thought that this would resolve the issue. And the and of course, you know, I was already had concerns about whether this was going to be a much longer conflict than that. But at the time, many people in DOD and many people in the administration thought that this was going to be an easy problem to wrap up, and it would be resolved. And it was only about 2 months later, about June, that I proceeded to tell some of my staff to start assembling a database of casualties, et cetera, in Iraq, because I felt that it was going to be going on long enough that we were going to need to track it and possibly have to do some work on this.
When you were starting up this database, how is it you were able to even get enough information? There's so much in military operations that is kept from the public, and we just get little clips of this, that, or the other. Media is more into what I call the entertainment mentality rather than honestly giving out a lot of facts. This is my personal bias. It's very frustrating, I think, for many Americans to feel like they're being kept out of the loop. How were you able to even begin to get enough data to start putting together a database?
Well, at the time, everything was very much open sources. The military had not shut down the sources, so they were reporting all the casualties, all the events. We were able to actually call a contractor over in Iraq and have them send us their weekly status reports as to what's going on in Iraq, the weekly status and intelligence reports. So at the time, in 2004, 2005, the data was very open and accessible. And then we ended up bringing in a number of people to interview that had just come back from service in Iraq. So we had, you know, and there was, of course, reporters over there and everything else. So particularly USA Today reporters I talked to. So there was open knowledge, and we were getting weekly reports from them, or daily reports, in fact, from them. It was not a problem of finding. At least for the top-level statistics, we were looking for finding the data on Iraq at the time.
In your data research, was there enough information about cultural points and the civilian environments? In the Middle East, there are so many different factors and factions that are engaged. And I recall an interview that I did a number of years ago with a diplomat, and he said that there were so many different tribes, there were so many different aspects of thinking, there were so many different feudal things going on among peoples. How were you able, or were you even able, to get any of this detailed aspect of the environment that we were going into to fight?
We didn't look in detail at that because that was really not part of our task. I mean, the original task we had, the original contract we awarded in 2004, was to do a casualty estimation and a duration estimate for how long we'd be in Iraq. And that is makes up the first chapter of the book. So we were aware of the problems. We did not specifically look into it in depth because our customer was not asking for it, and of course, it in itself is a very complex task.
Yes, it is. What you state is that you used 28 cases, and please correct me if I'm wrong, and that in your research, insurgencies occurring in small countries, the insurgents won only 14% of the time. In medium-sized countries, they won only 43% of the time. In large countries, they won 71% of the time. To compile this information, to bring it together, when you first started doing this with the group that you were with, this is something. How many people did you have on staff to be able to even bring these details together?
Well, we had done work on this subject, looking at various interventions and insurgencies back in 1983. There was a couple of years that the staff at Trevor Dupree's old company had done some work. And then when Bosnia came up in 1995, I assembled that material plus some additional research into a database that we did for our estimate in Bosnia. We provided an estimate of casualties for Bosnia, the Bosnia intervention in 1995 for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So we had already done this. So there was already, we already had an existing database, an existing collection of material. So when it came time to do this first casualty estimate, which was done under, I think, about a four-month contract, we already had a lot of the material already assembled. And then I had assistance from two other staff people to basically put it together and put together our initial casualty estimates for Iraq. So it was primarily the work of me with two other people.
Well, that's just amazing. Of course, computers help a great deal. But there were 10 points that you provided. And to me, it just, when I was reading this, I thought, gee, this makes sense. How is it someone would not be aware of it? When you are looking at going to war, it's very difficult to control large countries. It's difficult to control large populations. It's difficult to control an extended land border. Limited outside support does not doom an insurgency. Disorderly insurgencies are very intractable and often successful. I put that in my mind, guerrilla warfare, and insurgencies with large intervening forces above 95,000 are often very successful, and higher combat intensities do not doom an insurgency. Just reading those 10 points, it's like, ho-ho, do we go for a cup of coffee, or are we going to start to sweat bullets? What was the response to that?
Well, I remember I gave, just before the holidays, or just during the Christmas holidays, I was invited over to an Army agency to give this briefing. And I ended up giving the briefing on those points. And when I finished giving it, one of the colonels sitting there at the table says, as he's drinking his cup of coffee, says, "That's a hell of a thing to start the morning with."
No kidding.
And so, Jeez. You know, the reality is, you know, at this point, the insurgency in Iraq was very small. And it was still rattling around at a very low level. And, you know, what I was basically saying is it's going to get worse. Mm-hmm. There's no way you can, it's not going to get worse. And of course, there were people either, you know, there were people who were going to be serving over there or had come back from there already. And so it was very real to them. So mostly what I got was a quiet room and some thank yous. They then had me brief it up at the Undersecretary of Defense level, and again I got thank yous. But I think the I think the I'm not sure what they did with the material or the data, but they basically funded me to do more research after that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the problem was is that the political leadership was already had an established story as to what was going to happen in Iraq in 2004, 2005, and what I was saying did not match or blend with that established story very well. So I think people were a little concerned about briefing it further up the line.
Directed insurgencies or centrally directed are insurgencies with clear leadership and direction, but without the disciplined command structure. Those words were quite significant when I was reading them. Leadership is so vitally important. And with a lot of these insurgencies, they don't necessarily have that clear leadership. But if they do, then their methodical application of purpose and output of energy can be extraordinarily powerful. And this you also made a comment about the most dangerous insurgencies are those fueled by good old-fashioned nationalism. Why is it people want to ignore that?
I actually don't think they do ignore that. I think most people sort of instinctually understand that. But the, you know, the model that we were dealing with, you know, in many cases, a lot of people's knowledge of insurgency was one case, which was Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the largest insurgency since World War II. And in Vietnam, of course, you had a centrally directed command that had command functions all the way down to all the levels of insurgencies. They had commissars. They had political officers. It was all done under the name of communism, et cetera. So that was kind of the, you know, part of the examination of that is, you know, if a insurgency is not tightly controlled and tightly directed like the Vietnamese insurgency was, are they still dangerous? And the answer was yes. In
mm-hmm.
fact, the ones that have no central command, like, for example, the Afghanis against the Soviet Union, the ones that had no tightly organized structure seemed to have a durability and sustainment that was dangerous enough.
That's very true. And one of the things that the Soviets were not prepared for was the willingness of individuals to take on responsibility to do whatever they felt they necessarily needed to do to protect what they felt was their land, their families. This was very much a part of early American history. That's one of the things that America did to defeat the British.
Well, if you know, we eventually ended up focusing on insurgent cause as one of the major drivers. You
mm-hmm.
know, if the insurgents are motivated by an idea that it reaches across a broad stretch of their society, then you potentially have a very dangerous situation. You know, because the underlying element, which we're not able to fully explore, is, of course, the issue of recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as you can recruit people and draw people into your insurgency, then you can maintain the war for year after year, and in some cases for decade after decade. So it really depends on how powerful the cause is. Obviously, nationalism is a natural cause that a lot of people can be drawn into. More theoretical causes like communism or an Islamic state, that may not have the same power.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, any insurgency that occurs in the country where it's being done by a group that's a clear minority in the country, a racial minority or an ethnic minority or a regional group of people, that doesn't have the same power or reach.
That's very true. And I think 9/11 was a good demonstration of that in the American environment, how people pulled together just very, very quickly. It was really quite a phenomenal result. But the same thing happened after Pearl Harbor when that hit. It is very true what you're saying. In your publication, America's Modern Wars, you also go into quite a bit of history. You go into the studying of Mao Zedong's guerrilla warfare publications, the U.S. Army doctrinal manuals, modern insurgency and counterinsurgency theorists. All of this was researched by you as well. How significant was that research in your reports?
It was all part of it. Now, at the point that we, you know, we after we did the original Iraq estimate, Iraq casualty estimate, we ended up getting a series of contracts, and this was done over a couple of years, and our staff expanded during the process. So, you know, at the peak of the effort, we had about 10 people working on this. You know, and what we were basically trying to do was trying to get a complete understanding of insurgencies and what fueled them, what motivated them, and, you know, what was the major factors in understanding what makes them dangerous. And so we ended up developing a database of, at the time I did the analysis, we had 83 insurgencies in our database. So we had greatly expanded, and they were all post-World War II insurgencies. We had greatly expanded the number of cases.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea of using a large number of cases, of course, is to sort of wash out your exceptions. There's always a few unusual cases where things go better than you, better than they should, or worse than they should. Or there's a few factors that heavily influence that case. So it was a matter of, I didn't want to do case studies. What I wanted to do was look at the whole broad range of all 80 plus cases to see what the patterns are, see what the norms are.
Boots on the ground is a term that's often used. I've heard more than one politician say, we need boots on the ground, or various interviews, or we need boots on the ground. And this is something that for many people in their minds, when they hear it, means more soldiers that are going to be sent out. But there was something that was said in your book that there was an assumption that there were 10 to 12 government troops needed to tie down a single guerrilla, and that it was an illusion. The insurgents are a very unique environment to deal with. Boots on the ground. What did your research come up with relative to that?
You know, we ended up, when we actually sat there and mapped out the ratio of the number of troops versus the estimated number of insurgencies across all these 60 or so insurgencies that we looked at for this analysis, we ended up with a graph that clearly showed that the more troops that you had relative to the number of insurgents, the more chance you had of winning.
Mm-hmm.
Until eventually it appeared that for insurgencies, once you got more than 10 or so troops in an insurgency versus an insurgent, you most, more often than not, won that insurgency, like 80 or 90% of the time. So we ended up putting together a series of charts that looked at that. So we ended up with basically a graph that showed force ratios on one side and percent success on the other. And the data pretty much solidly fit into that graph. Now, oddly enough, the whole argument about strength of forces needed to defeat an insurgency became unpopular and was dismissed back in the 60s and 70s. And I don't know why it was dismissed. It was not based upon any analysis that I've ever seen. So it kind of fell out of the cycle as being needed. But in the end, if you don't properly support, you know, when you're looking at the forces that you need to fight the counterinsurgency campaign, of course, you not only have to fight the insurgents, you also have to protect all your cities, all your villages, all your routes in between. And there's a significant garrison requirement. You know, if they can take over a small town and cause havoc for 2 or 3 days and then withdraw from that small town, then you've kind of lost your political influence and power there, and they've gained it.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of this ends up being tied down in the forms of garrison and holding down areas, because you have to protect everything. And they merely have to go in and disrupt.
Mm-hmm.
and then they have to be able to recruit. As long as they can disrupt and recruit, they can maintain the insurgency. And they can maintain it long enough to hopefully wear you down. It's what they're trying to do.
And we're seeing a lot of that even today. That has not gone away. There was some information that you have in your book that I found very interesting. This was a tentative conclusion that increased levels of brutality favor the insurgency when the number of civilians killed each year averages more than 8 per 100,000 in population. Someone hearing that might say, how can you just use such numbers like that? But they do make a difference. And you have the other side of that. Let's discuss that for a minute, because we have major populations that have been affected around the world by insurgencies that have just suffered terrible, terrible losses, men, women, and children. And this is something, you boil it down to these numbers. It's so cold when you think about it. Here's just the number, 8 in 100,000. Wow. What's the other side of this?
Well, the number came about because we were literally looking at civilian deaths in the population compared to whether the insurgency was successful or not. And what we tended to see was a tendency for the more violent the insurgency was, or the counterinsurgency was, we never identified who was killing who, but the more violent the thing got, the more it favored the insurgents.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't... I think it lists as a tentative conclusion because the data wasn't in a large enough cases or wasn't clear enough that we could get good statistical measures for it. But it tended to point that way. And in my book, I spent the time to put all the data and all the tests in there, which makes for a little bit of heavy reading. But I figure that is useful for people to understand why we tend to lean that way. So what it basically comes down to is that you want to somehow or the other, if you're fighting an insurgency, is try to keep the levels of violence at a lowest possible level, especially the level of violence to civilians at the lowest possible level, whether that's done by you or done by the insurgents. You want to somehow or the other bring the conflict, levels of violence in the conflict down.
Mm-hmm. I know that I've talked with those that have been in the medevac units that have been with their boots on the ground, dealing with situations every day with wounded men, women, and children, and how significant an impact that they had. And when I listened to the stories of these men and women, when they were right there on the front lines, they were tending to whoever needed to be tended to. They really didn't care what side you were on. It was very, very, very empowering, and a lot of people that would have been an enemy changed their image right away. It was really quite special to hear their stories.
You know, the much of the issue is about recruitment. So from a statistical point of view, if you're facing an insurgency force that has, let's say, 60,000 people, which may be the strength of the insurgency in Afghanistan, we don't really know. But if you're facing an insurgency force that has 60,000 people, if they can recruit another 15,000 people every year, then they can maintain forever.
Mm-hmm.
There's a limit to how much damage you can cause to them. So, you know, at some point you have to address, you know, do I control the population areas where those insurgents are being recruited from? Do I do things to make sure that people don't want to go to work for the insurgency? They don't want to be recruited. They're not inspired to do so. So, for example, a misdirected air attack, you know, can cause a lot of damage. It can also help the insurgent recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of necessary to make sure that you do everything to not give the insurgents more bases for recruitment, because in the end you've got to wear them down, and that means you've got to not only wear their existing force down, but you've also got to undermine the recruitment. And we didn't do a lot of work on recruitment. We would have if we had continued the effort, but all of our work on this effort ended about 2009.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Iraq for a little bit. You give information that I was not aware of, and I don't know that any of my listeners were aware of this, that in December 2009, the United States lost no soldiers to combat in Iraq for that month. This was the first time in 81 months that the U.S. had been in Iraq that we had gone through a month without a combat loss. Now, I just heard a click. Christopher, are you still with me? I think we have lost my guest, so let me get him back on the line. Something happened to his phone. Hello? Let me give him a call back. I think somehow or another there was an interference on his end. We're talking with Christopher Lawrence on America's Modern Wars.
I'm back.
Yes, Christopher, I don't know what happened. We lost you for a minute.
It just went quiet at this end, so I hung the phone up and I figured you'd call back.
Yes, I did. We're talking about December 2009. It was the first time in 81 months that the United States had been in Iraq that there was this one month that there was not one loss in combat. Now, were you constantly getting reports? Were you getting daily reports, or was information being filtered that was sent to you?
We were still assembling every week the reports on the casualties. So, you know, I had one person specifically who did that, and that was still open source material.
You say the U.S. strategy in Iraq had gone through several shifts over time. What were those shifts? What happened?
Well, that could be a very long discussion. The major dramatic turnabout was, of course, the surge that occurred in Iraq. And the surge conveniently occurred at about the same time that people started having extensive discussions with the various groups of Sunni Iraqis who were wanting to help put down this insurgency.
Oh my goodness, his phone died again. This is Donna Sebo, and my guest today, Christopher Lawrence.
You have reached the Dupuy Institute. Please leave a message. We will get back to you.
Something's happening with his phone, so I'm going to try to call him again. For whatever reason, there is a disconnection that keeps occurring.
Sorry?
Hello, Christopher. It seems like this must be irritating the gnomes of the telephone system, our conversation.
I don't know what's happening.
All right. So what happened with the surges? What was significant about the surges?
So the significant events that occurred at about the time we were doing the surge was that they actually ended up approaching us. And some of the details are provided in other books as how this actually happened. But a group of Iraqi Sunnis ended up approaching us basically saying, we don't like these insurgents either. Can you give us some help? And we ended up, when the whole process was done over the course of a year, we ended up with over 100,000 Sunni Iraqis organized into militia units that were on the U.S. payroll. And this did two things. Number one, it put defensive forces, 100,000 people in these various cities, defending these areas. It also took off the street a large number of people who potentially could be recruited. And in some cases, it actually recruited insurgents to go fight for us. So people who were on one side had switched over because, you know, this was a better arrangement. And so so we did the surge. We were there with increased troops for about 2 years. We pulled them out. But what really changed the environment on the ground was this migration, this creation of 100,000 Sunni Iraqis who were clearly no longer fighting us and in many cases helping us. And this was what really sort of turned the Iraq war around.
The Awakening Councils, you
yes.
mentioned them. Were they all Sunnis or were they composites of different groups?
It was mostly built from Sunnis.
Then you
the
made...
As the significant part of the insurgency was Sunni. You know, the fundamental nature of the insurgency was that it was a Sunni insurgency. So it was what I would call a regional or factionalized insurgency. So, you know, once we, you know, we were not having a major insurgency problem in the Shiite areas of Iraq. Most of the insurgents were Sunnis. And so once we could get the, once we could create, we could work with the Sunnis and draw them into the government and draw them into militia units that we were paying, that solved a lot of the problems very quickly.
There was a statement that you made that though Iraq was not Vietnam, it was a good yardstick for comparing a hopefully successful withdrawal to a withdrawal that was clearly not successful. Would you still stand by that statement?
I thought we withdrew too quick. We needed to take our time getting out of there. And that's why you see the hedge word, hopefully successful. I thought it was too quick.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, what developed with the Islamic State was fundamentally, you know, it was fundamentally fueled out of Iraq. And they migrated to Syria and then they came back to Iraq. It was fundamentally a continuation of the Iraq insurgency. We had basically pulled out too quickly, and we needed to stay there with at least a holding force of 20,000 to 60,000 people until such time as we were certain that everything was under control.
There's always shifts that will occur within an environment. I mean, we've had them here in the United States. It's an ongoing situation. New generations come up without an understanding of the past. With all of this work that you're doing and that you continue to do in providing statistical analysis, with the current environment as it is, what is the most important information that needs to be assessed? No nation, if they're in their leaders are in their right mind, want to go to war. War is extraordinarily expensive. Lives, the costs of equipment, transportation, the backup teams that are necessary just to take care of the basic needs of a military structure, and then some. With all that you've done with this, what do you feel currently we really need to look at?
I think we need to go back to looking at this material. Part of the sense I have now with the industry is that because of the changing missions of the U.S. military, we've gotten so involved in training exercises and small special forces operations that we're losing sort of the big picture and understanding the big picture. And so what I see from a practical point of view is that a lot of sort of analysis and understanding of this type of work is not going on at the moment. There was a certain sense, you know, all of our work on this ended in 2009. There was a certain sense that as we were winning the Iraq War, we had solved the problem, therefore we didn't need to look any further.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we ended up doing the surge in Afghanistan, and it didn't solve the problem. And that should have told you that we had really not figured out how to solve the problem.
America in its history usually is sort of lackadaisical about how it prepares for the aspect of war. And so many things have changed. Technology has enabled communication literally in seconds. Not 100%, but in many ways it has been made available. Military training has changed. We've got a lot of technology that's out in the field. But when you get down to the basics, it seems like the American attitude is waiting until the last minute. You make a statement, and it's in your chapter, Where Do We Go From Here?, that the big problem lies in the government, at least the parts that you've dealt with, Because too often the people in political authority have the attention span of a 2-year-old. And I would say there's probably a majority of Americans that would go, yes, I agree with that. Why aren't they thinking things out? But you're also adamant about the American public needing to be educated. This is not an easy thing to do when you have so much in media that's all about entertainment, not really bringing the facts out. How do you think that you and people like you who are engaged in this kind of research can make a difference? How can you make your voice heard?
I'm not sure, actually. Let's take the example of Vietnam for a second. The United States pulled out of Vietnam in 1973. If you try to find a series of studies and analysis done by the Department of Defense or done by analytical agencies as to what happened in Vietnam, why we lost, what we could have done in Vietnam to win, you won't find anything after in the 70s or 80s or thereafter. So we fought this massive guerrilla war, and then we chose not to learn any lessons from it, except sort of this sort of nebulous thing, well, we don't want to get in one of those wars again. Well, we got into 2 of them, in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in many respects, we had to relearn the lessons. And we were denying that we were even in those types of wars the first couple of years we were in those wars. So so I don't know how to get to the point where the decision makers are being educated in this. But in the case, when I started this insurgency work in 2004, at one analytical agency I was coordinating with, they had about over 120 people working for them. I asked them in 2004, how many insurgency specialists do you have on staff? And the answer was 0. So even in 2004, we were not prepared to fight an insurgency. We had not studied it. We had not analyzed it. We had not understood it. We were very much focused on our current mission, which is fighting conventional wars, which we're very good at. And so how do you get the Army to study missions that are currently not doing that may come up in the future? And that's been a struggle. And I do not know how to correct that problem.
Your statement, corrective action is probably much cheaper in being aware of 3 stages. A, pre-insurgency. B, proto-insurgency, which is representative of the early stages of an insurgency. And C, developed insurgency, one that has clearly developed. There's more than one example in your publication, America's Modern Wars, where if that had been done, a lot of the scenarios that evolved might not have happened. So the old scout model of be prepared is something that seems to be ignored, and it's really a sad statement.
Well, there was the realization as we were completing our studies that all we had studied was major insurgencies that were going on. And the question is how do you identify them as they're still developing before they've blown up into a major fight? And that would be the cheapest time to control them or to change them or bring the situation under control. But we have not done any studies on that, and we are not aware of too many other people who have.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the things we were trying to get the Department of Defense to look at.
My goodness, there goes his phone. His phone seems to be having a temper tantrum. So let's get him back on again. This is Donna Sebo. I am interviewing Christopher Lawrence, America's Modern Wars. One of the things that he
You have reached the Dupuy Institute.
One of the points that he's very significant about is that we as individuals, and I know that there are those of you listening in different parts of the world, we as individuals need to ask the questions. and get the information. Christopher, are you with me again?
I'm back here with you again.
I don't know what's wrong with your phone, but I think it's got a case of indigestion because of this subject matter.
I'm wondering if it's shutting off every time somebody calls in.
Might be. I don't know. But this is there's a point that you bring out in your book that I think is very significant. You say the American public pays a lot of taxes so that a government can run, so that the military can operate. This is something that many times people don't realize, that a government does not generate the income that it survives on. It comes from the working people of the United States. This is a factor in any country. But you really want the American individual to ask questions, to demand information. That is one of the hardest things to do with the political environment because usually, this is my observation, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing, and doing whatever is politically expedient comes first. This is a real challenge when it comes to talking about these things.
Yes, and I'm going to try to avoid getting into politics, but fundamentally, you are talking about a need for a more educated voter.
Yes.
And that would imply also a need for shows and broadcasts that are more focused on giving the bigger picture and looking at affairs overseas than looking at all the current little rumors, conversations, and other things going on right now. So, you know, if I turn on any news station now, what I'm mostly getting is the conversation of the day about whatever local issue is going on. And you know, if you want to stay current on international news, you pretty much have to go to non-U.S. sources.
Mm-hmm.
And so there is a tendency now for, unless you go out searching for the data, there is a tendency for the rest of the world to sort of disappear off of everyone's map.
Which I think is a huge mistake. Because we're all interconnected. And this is something where if we're not aware of what's going on, and if there is not the demand of the citizenry, of their media, and of their representatives to not speak in political garble, but really look at what those facts are, I think we would be extraordinarily more aware and then demand that qualified people who are going to think, which is something that is not easily done, but who are really going to think about what is the bigger picture? What is the bigger picture? Because we have to look at the economics. We have to look at so many different factors, just like we do in everyday life. Well, the representatives need to be held accountable for that.
Mm-hmm.
The military needs to be held accountable for that. And your comment about dealing with the special forces, we need the special forces, but we also really need to have an understanding of the cultural environments that we're engaging in. I think one of the factors that really was an amazing thing to me is how many people are assigned to be in environments that culturally are so very, very unique and different, and they haven't even had an hour of time in education about a culture that they're entering into. All of this plays into the factor of being able to have the communication with those boots on the ground that so often is mentioned, and it's just not looked at. That is something.
Well, you know, the Army and the Marine Corps has gotten much better at this from the first days they arrived. And, of course, part of that is because of the sheer amount of time they've spent over there, and many people have served multiple tours in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So there has been an educational level. You know, nowadays there's, you know, no lack of actual on-the-ground experience at this point. They're very knowledgeable of what they do. And, of course, the fact that we could put together the awakening councils is an indication that they had figured that out in the case of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And were able to get an actual real result about it. So there's been a lot of progress, but the most of these are what I call complex problems. And we have a bias towards trying to find simple solutions. And, you know, if you could find a simple solution to a complex problem, it would have been solved long ago. And so most of these problems are fairly complex, and they need to be fully understood, and then they need to be systematically addressed. And that does not always fit in with the dialogue that's going on in the political world.
That is very, very true. You also address the analytical community, of which you are a very important part. You say, we really need to understand every aspect of warfare. Do you believe that that's possible?
There's been a tendency to be focused on the current set of missions, and not to be, and the Army analytical agencies and the educational agencies all tend to be focused on the missions currently going on. And so there's been a tendency for them to forget about other aspects of missions or other things they might have to do while they're doing their current missions. And they don't study it, they don't analyze it, they don't understand it. So the Army has a tendency, as it's doing one mission, to forget about its other missions. And that has showed up in multiple cases. We're now suddenly seeing an interest in the Marine Corps and the Army of training and preparing for conventional war. Now, you would think that that would always be something that they were focused on. But in fact, with all the deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq and all the insurgencies going on and the fighting in Syria, they had, in fact, lost focus on that.
Uh-huh.
And so there needs to be some type of, you know, within each branch, some type of overarching structure that is making sure that they're looking at all aspects of all the potential missions they'll have in the future. And this has been a problem in the past, and I suspect it's still a problem now.
I appreciated your commentary that you said we really need to understand the wars we've been engaged in are America's wars, and get off of blaming, let's say, a president. The voter, the American voter, has a big responsibility, and I'm going to quote from your book, to review one's credentials, experience, knowledge, and capabilities before an election. Actions are overseen and approved by Congress, and not a penny is spent on these wars without the approval of the elected representatives of Congress. This is something that I really think needs to be brought home and to the consciousness and awareness of the American people. We have a group of individuals that are deciding on this. They're deciding on the budgets for the military. And the scout adage, I think, is very important. Be prepared. We need to have that status of preparation. And this is so very important for the average individual to understand. And you say it's up to us as Americans to recognize our responsibility for who actually runs the government, and it's our job to make sure that things are done right. And your question is, how's the attitude about the last 12 years? What do you think about what they've done? Well, I think the average American thinks it stinks.
You know, the point needs to be driven home. The American people run the government. We choose everyone who's in charge. They choose everyone. They may choose who's appointed thereafter, but we choose who's in charge. And that's done through voting, putting in the congressmen, putting in the senators, voting in presidents, et cetera. So, you know, it's if the government is not working the way we want it to do, it's fundamentally our responsibility. It's our fault. And there's a tendency to somehow or the other believe that it's some mystical thing in Washington going on that is perverting everything that's going on. In fact, we're the people who are voting in and putting them in. We have the responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
And as voters, we need to take that responsibility seriously.
And in part, that then demands education. That demands that we be willing to think. That demands that we be willing to challenge. That is a part of our basic DNA as Americans. And I think sometimes we have to get our backs up, and that is very, very important. And freedom is not something that is gained just because we think about it. It is something that we have to reinforce and we have to work with. Statistical analysis, as you have presented it in America's Modern Wars, what do you see its role in the future?
Right now, inside of the Department of Defense, it appears to be in the wane. There just seems to be not a lot of it going on that I have seen lately. And of course, what I was specifically doing, which is quantitative analysis of historical affairs and historical cases of quantitative analysis of military history, I'm not aware of any efforts going on related to that right now.
So if you were to address a group of Americans, or that young people especially, what would you want them to be aware of?
I think they need to be aware of the world, the whole world, and what's going on. I have a son in high school, so he is aware of what's going on in the world. He's traveled out into it. He's aware of other news sources. He watches other news sources outside of American news. So, these are complex situations, and it's a complex world. And so, it's hard to be aware of it all and know it all. But, you can certainly make yourself knowledgeable in a few areas. As a voter, you probably need to take the time to understand the issues and understand the complexities of the issues, because they're not going to be solved easily.
Very true.
And we've seen this in multiple cases recently.
Very, very true. Christopher Lawrence, this has been a fascinating conversation. Your book, America's Modern Wars, is quite a read, and it brings a lot of thoughts. I want to thank you for being with me. Now, you have a blog, Mystics and Statistics, that is connected with the Dupuy Institute, and their website is DupuyInstitute.org, and that's DupuyInstitute.org. I want to thank you for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for the time, and sorry about the communication problems.
Well, those things happen. Thank you again for being my guest. Donna Sebo, as I'm closing out the show, I want to share a statement with you by a man, John Stuart Mill. A people may prefer a free government, but if from indolence or carelessness or cowardice or for want of public spirit they're unequal to the exertions necessary for preserving it, if they will not fight for it when it is directly attacked, if by momentary discouragement or temporary panic or a fit of enthusiasm for an individual, they can be induced to lay their liberties at the feet even of a great man, or trust him with powers which enable him to subvert their institutions, in all these cases they are more or less unfit for liberty, and even though it may be for their good to have had it, even for a short time, they are unlikely long to enjoy it. Dealing with truth is something that can be very distasteful. It's so easy to be captured by the entertainment of media. But what about the questions? Where do they get their sources of information? What are the facts? What is it that we are not being told? Can we do research, investigation, so we can find out what needs to be known? And are we going to be brave enough to talk about it as well? Discussion is important. Removing blinders, sometimes blinders of fear, or complacency, is extremely important as well. Remember, freedom is not free. You have a choice. What choice are you going to make? What are you going to choose? To keep that freedom, or just let it evaporate?
This is Donna Sebo.
Thank you for joining me and my guests for this dynamic and informational hour. Tell your friends and family about the program. We look forward to having you join us again. Have a magnificent and free life.